If you would, take out your Bible and open up to Genesis chapter 40. Genesis chapter 40. If you think through these situations that we've been looking at for such a long time, in terms of thinking in terms of what we know in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 and 8, God is not mocked, do not be deceived. What a man sows, this he will also reap. And if you look in the life of Joseph, he continues to sow to what is good. He continues to sow to what is right. And yet there are times where he's sold off by his brothers. There's times where there are false accusations made against him. And there's times where he's even, because of that, thrown into prison. And yet, what does the Lord continue to do? He continues to bless him. He continues to be with him. And he continues to take care of him. Even no matter what the difficult circumstances are, you see how the Lord can take those, mold them, and shape them in a way that is beneficial for Joseph. And he talked about at the end of chapter 39 that whatever Joseph did, the Lord made to prosper. And it's not necessarily about the Joseph's making money. It's really the idea about his name is really being put forward in terms of that he would prosper and be blessed by God. Now, chapter 40 is a little bit unique in the sense of, at this point in time, Joseph's about 28 years old. We saw in chapter 39 that it kind of covered Joseph's life from the age of 17 to almost 30 years old within the range of just chapter 39. Chapter 40 is going to all take place around the age of 28 for Joseph. I always say around because that gives me a little leeway. It could be a little bit, a few months before, a few months after. But looking at his life, I know from time to time I tell you these ages, and maybe you just look at me and you go, okay, if that's what he says, it must be what it is. I'm going to tell you that it's sometimes just math, and I'll show it to you real quick. And sometimes it's about dates that are coming down the line that you can figure backwards and find these things on. Just real quickly, look over at Genesis 41. And look at verse 46. Genesis chapter 41, verse 46. It says, now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. So, you know, as a matter of fact, in chapter 41, verse 46, Joseph is 30 years old. Now, back up to the first verse of chapter 41. Now it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he was standing by the Nile. So, you know, he's 30 years there. You know, it's 2 years at this point. I'm sure you're this good at math. 30 minus 2 equals 28. So you come to understand chapter 40 takes place whenever he's about 28 years old. And to think about all these difficulties that he's been through, from the age of 17 to the age of 28. I mean, these are not easy things to endure. And yet, he still remains faithful to God. And through all these difficulties, he is able to see that it's the Lord that's with him and making these things come together. Even to the point where Potiphar could tell that it was because the Lord was with him. The chief jailer could tell it was because the Lord was with him. They could see it even on the outside looking in, even still being pretty well ignorant of the God of Israel. Now, looking in Genesis chapter 40, now look at verse 1. Then it came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Now, here it just talks about him being the cupbearer and the baker, but you'll see their elevated position. Look at verse 2. Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. Now, in verse 1, it just sounds like they had offended Pharaoh. How does it further explain that in verse 2? How did he take this offense? He's furious. Furious with them. And notice in verse 1, it doesn't tell you their full position, but in verse 2, it tells you what's the position of this baker and cupbearer. Chief. I mean, these are the head guys who are over these responsibilities. And Pharaoh is furious with these two men. Just flat out furious. And he's so furious, verse 3. The captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them. Excuse me, verse 3. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. Now, keep in mind, time has passed through chapter 39. Here in verse 3 it says, in the house of the captain of the bodyguard. Have we been introduced to a captain of the bodyguard before? Think back to chapter 39 and look at verse 1. What was his name? Potiphar. Same position, right? He says, captain of the bodyguard. Now, here's the thing, though. You notice how it doesn't bring up Potiphar's name here in chapter 40? It just gives you the general title. And have there been years that have passed between these two? Yes. So it doesn't appear like Potiphar is still the captain of the bodyguard, but it could be. So we'll just leave it at that. So here we are in chapter 40, verse 3. So we put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, in the jail, in the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. So here's Pharaoh, who's furious with these two chiefs, and all of a sudden, they come into the same place where Joseph is. Now, the situation at hand goes just a little bit further. Look at verse 4. The captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. And you may have a footnote for some time. Anybody got one? What does it say? Days. I mean, a season even. And you think, okay, this is not some, they're just there for a couple of days. This is like, they're there for days. I notice it doesn't say they're there for months. It just says they're there for days. And so you get a little bit of picture of time of going, here they are, they're entrusted to Joseph. And once again, the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them. And so you see how this picture is going. Nothing like being the one who is over this whole complex in one sense, if you want to call it a complex. Look back at chapter 39 and verse 22, just to remember. It says, the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. Because they could tell that Joseph was so favored, what did he get as his reward? More responsibility. Doesn't always turn out the way you hoped. But at the same time, with more favor, here comes more responsibility. And now that responsibility comes down to, even if you were a prisoner sent to jail by the Pharaoh himself, it's still under whose responsibility? Joseph's. Now, here's kind of the situation for the moment. There for days, then look at verse 5. It says, then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in jail, both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream and each dream with its own interpretation. So these two men show up, and if you're not familiar with what a cupbearer really is, if you can imagine how many people want to eliminate a king, a good way to do that is to poison what he drinks or what he eats. And then you can kind of cover up your tracks a little bit. So they got wise enough in these olden days to go, how about somebody else takes a drink first? How about somebody else gets to taste the king's food first? And so that's kind of the role of the cupbearer, and probably, especially the cupbearer, maybe for the chief baker as well, of going, you want to make sure that if you're the Pharaoh, the king, that what you're going to eat is not going to kill you. Now, and we're not talking about taste so much, but the other ideas. So here he is. Here they are, verse 5, they're confined, and it just so happens that on the same night, they both have a dream. He says, and each man with his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. I don't know if you've ever showed up to work, and somebody says, hey, I had this dream last night. And depending on who the person is, you may go, what was it? Or you may go, I think I have other things to go do. I'd rather work than listen to whatever this story is going to be. So you start to kind of notice, here's the situation, and then specifically notice verse 6. When Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, because this is what his role is, right? He's to take care of these prisoners. He says, so he comes to them in the morning and observed them, and behold, how did they look? They were sad. They were dejected. So how do they feel about these dreams? Not good. Now, have you ever had a dream at night and you wake up the next morning and it's just puzzling to you? Now, we're going to deal with this here in a little bit, but just on the surface, you have some dream. Maybe you have a dream where you did something that you go, I wouldn't do that. That was definitely the wrong choice to make in whatever kind of situation you dreamed up. And you can be kind of sad by it. Now, here they were. He says they were dejected, so they have this emotional response, disheartened, maybe discouraged. In verse 7, here's what Joseph notices. He says he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? Now, it's not as if Joseph goes, I know exactly what's going on here. You guys have had some dreams, and I'm here to let you know what they mean. He comes in to take care of these two prisoners, and he sees the look on their face that it's sad. And so what does he do? He just asks a question. He says, why are your faces so sad today? Like, what changed between when I saw you yesterday and the way you look now? Have you ever noticed somebody, maybe a day-to-day life, and you see them one day, they look just fine. The next day you see them, and they don't look so fine. And you go, is there something wrong? You don't just turn around and go, hey, put on a happy face. Don't be that guy or that woman. But go, why are you so sad today? And sometimes they'll say, oh, nothing. Okay. Don't go pressing your nose into places it shouldn't be. But notice kind of this picture. Now, I want to take just a moment to look over to Ecclesiastes for a little bit. I want you to think about Solomon gives some interesting instruction about dreams. Look over to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, look down at verse 3. And don't worry, we're not going off in left field, I hope. Please don't take me out to left field. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, look at verse 3. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. Have you ever had an experience where you leave music running, and you fall asleep, then all of a sudden you have a dream where that music is playing because of outside sources? Or maybe you watched a video of something very intense before you went to bed, and all of a sudden your dream has something to do with that. And you go, just kind of part of how the human brain is wired. But I want you to notice here's Solomon. He says, for the dream comes through much effort. He says, if you spend all your time thinking about something, don't be surprised if you have a dream about it. He says, and so what do you do with that? He says, oh, and the voice of a fool through many words. He says, that also takes a lot of effort. Then look down a little bit further to verse 7. Same chapter, Ecclesiastes 5, 7. For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. What is typically going on in dreams? Does it really have a bearing on what's going on in real life? No. Don't be held captive. We'll deal with that, hopefully, if we get time. But notice the tail end of the verse, which is much more important. What does he say? Rather fear God. So many times, people will be overrun by their dreams. They'll have some kind of crazy dream, and they'll go, this is the direction that I'm supposed to take, and I'm supposed to, and you go, emptiness. Typically, it's emptiness. We'll see some exceptions to that. But notice the other part is rather fear God. If you already know what God desires of you to do, walk in the ways of God. Don't let your dreams carry you off away from what God has commanded. Now, just keep that in mind. Now, come back to Genesis chapter 40. So Joseph asked them, "Why are your faces so sad?" Verse 8. Then they said to him, "We have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it." He said, "Why are we so sad?" And they tell him why. "We had a dream, and we don't know what in the world it means." Now, in chapter 41, there's going to be some people who are around Pharaoh who typically would interpret dreams. If you look in Genesis 41:8, it'll give you some terminology like magicians, and the footnote there might say soothsayers, and wise men. And they go, you know what? Typically, we're around Pharaoh, and we have access to these other guys, and on the side we can say, hey, here's what I dreamed. What do you think? But they're not around Pharaoh anymore. And now they have dreams, and what do they have to go with them? A sad face. That's what they have. And questions. Now, notice what Joseph does. Here's two men who are under his care, been there for many days. He sees the sad look on their face. He asks them a question. Why is this the case? They say, because we both had dreams, but we don't know what they mean. Joseph's response. Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" Who does Joseph point to? He points to God. He says, isn't God in control over everything? Now, we know from Solomon, dreams are typically empty. There's nothing there. This is a different situation, isn't it? And notice where Joseph is taking this. Don't interpretations belong to God? Now, I hope this is kind of reminding you of the book of Daniel. Whenever Nebuchadnezzar has his dream. And Daniel, after nobody else can be found and their heads are on the chopping block about to die, to go, you know what? God's the one who can do this. And he asked his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to pray for him. That he would know not only what the interpretation is of the dream, but what the dream itself was. If you read through Daniel chapter 2. So, you realize there are times where God would speak through dreams. Old Testament, and maybe we'll get to see a little bit of that in the New Testament too. But don't think in general. It's a dream, it must be from God. It'll take you to emptiness. You've worked hard for your dream, perhaps. Now, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. He says, will you share it with me, what your dream was? Now, don't take that to mean Joseph saying, I'm God. You just tell me and I'll be able to tell you exactly what they mean. He's saying, interpretations belong to God. Would you share your dream with me? What you dreamed last night that has you so sad? Now, I want you to think about the heart of Joseph here. What's his job in this scenario? Take care of prisoners. And notice he doesn't just say, I gave them food, they have clothing, they have a place to sleep. To what extent is he willing to take care of them? Even overcome sadness, even the emotional side of things. So you look at that and you go, he's saying, maybe I can help you overcome this sadness. You see him willing to go what we would say, he's going the extra mile here. So, verse 9. Chief cupbearer. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me. And on the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. So I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup. And I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. He says, this was the dream that I had. And you notice, he says, vine's in front of me. The vine has three branches. those branches started budding and blossoming, and I saw these clusters. They produced ripe grapes. And so I did what I would typically do. I took the grapes, and I made the juice into them and put them in the Pharaoh's cup, and I handed it to Pharaoh's hand. He says, I had a drink. Now, how many times do you think the cupbearer had done that in his life? There's no telling. There is no telling. Now, some dreams come out of much labor, right? This is not things that are unfamiliar to him. He says, I had this dream, but what does it mean? And notice, here's Joseph, verses 12 and 13. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. Notice, Joseph doesn't say, I think, or it could be. He says, now this is what it means. Now, how did he know that? God, interpretation belongs to God. So in some way, shape, form, or fashion, he got it from God. Notice what he says. He says, the three branches are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. And you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. He says, here's what those 3 branches were about. That's 3 days. He says, and you're going to be right back where you were, and you're going to be putting those things in Pharaoh's hand again. This is what Joseph knows. But I want you to notice these next 2 verses. He doesn't just go, I think this is probably what's going to happen. He's saying, this is the way it's going to be in 3 days, and I want you to remember me. That's how much conviction he has in this to say, and don't forget me. Notice this request, verses 14 and 15. Only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. Does he want out of there? He does. Now, is he willing to take it in an evil way or to go on the run? No, he says, it's going to have to happen by somebody's authority. Does he know who's ultimately in control? He does. And is he willing to wait? He is. Patience. Patience. Notice how it continues, verse 15. He says, for I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews. And now, how long ago has that been? He's 28 now. How old was he when he was sold? 17. So it's been like 11 years. He's saying, I was kidnapped 11 years ago. He says, could I get out of this house? He says, you're going to stand before the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. He says, I was kidnapped out of the land of the Hebrews. He says, and even here I've done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon. He says, and there is nothing I did wrong to where I'm in prison right now. Does he know? Is that not what everybody says who's in prison? But yet at the same time, here he is. And he makes this statement and saying, I know I'm innocent, but that doesn't change the fact that I'm here. Now, while he's in prison, how does he respond to all these responsibilities? He goes the second mile, we would say. He goes well beyond what would typically be expected of someone. I'm not just taking care of food and clothing and a place to rest. He's like, I'm trying to take care of them on an emotional side to really even provide in ways when they get sad. You think prisoners get sad? And here he is looking at them. Eric. He's been there. Joseph's been there for a while, so I'm sure he's picked up on some language along the way. I would imagine that. And we'll find that later on in the book of Genesis. Whenever his brothers show up, he's speaking in an Egyptian language, and he has an interpreter there, so they think he can't understand. And they're talking about things, and Joseph knows exactly what they're saying. So he did pick up on the language later, probably already. Now, notice here, he says, even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into this dungeon. And yet, even though he is innocent, does he show resentment, bitterness? He's still willing to work as hard as he can out of honor for his God. Now, verse 16. When the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, now notice, what gets the chief baker's attention? Hey, if we're handing out good news, I could use some too. And so notice how he turns this over. When the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And I want you to just think in terms of humanity. One person starts sharing a dream. What's about to happen? Hey, I had a dream too. It's amazing how those conversations go. So don't be surprised. If you're going to share something about some dream you had with somebody, you better be ready to listen, because there's going to be more. You just see, that is not just something that's new. It's been around for a long time. Now, here it is. He says, in terms of his dream, he says, I also saw in my dream, behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. Three baskets on his head, verse 17. And in the top basket, there was some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. And the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. He says, this is what I saw. He says, I had this dream, and baskets were on my head. And in the top basket, there were all these baked goods for Pharaoh. And then all of a sudden, these birds started coming down and eating the bread out of the basket that was on my head. I mean, can you understand why they were going, what does this mean? Then, Joseph, verse 18. Then Joseph answered and said, this is its interpretation. Notice once again, he doesn't say, well, here's what I think that means. He says, this is the interpretation. Who gave it to him? God did. He knows, look, God's the one who interprets these things. He says, this is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. Does this sound familiar? Can you almost see the anticipation on the baker's face of what he might be thinking based upon what the cupbearer heard? 3 days. Ah, yeah, just like the cupbearer. He says, within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head. And up to that point, it sounds very, very similar to the cupbearer, doesn't it? And here's where it changes. From you, lift up your head from you, and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you. Oh. Do you imagine the chief baker wanted Joseph to be wrong? I'm sure he did. I want you to also notice something else here. There's not the next two verses where Joseph says, hey, when you get back in front of Pharaoh, don't forget me. Why? I don't want to be associated with this guy. I don't want him to be the one mentioning me to Pharaoh. And I know he's about to be dead in 3 days. And the birds are going to eat his flesh off his bones that are hanging. Now, that tells you a little something about Joseph. See how wise he is? He says, you know what? I know how things are going to turn out for you, the cupbearer. Remember me. For the chief baker, hey, I know how things are going to turn out for you. I don't have any requests. Then, verse 20. Now, keep in mind, here's an interpretation that's been given to both men. How long will it take to find out whether Joseph is right or not? 3 days. Now, like I said before, chapter 40, depending on how long these two men were in prison for days, chapter 40 could have taken place within a week. It could have taken place within maybe a month, maybe a little bit more, depending on what days really ties you to. But this is a chapter that goes pretty quick in terms of time, but its influence is going to last for a long time. So, verse 20. Thus it came about on the third day. All right, it's time to find out whether Joseph's interpretation by God is true or not. which was Pharaoh's birthday. It just so happened to be this third day is Pharaoh's birthday. And I want you to look a little bit into the heart of Pharaoh, because I think this is a little unique. He says that he made a feast for who? All his servants. Isn't that kind of something? Here it is, Pharaoh's birthday, and who is he thinking of? He's thinking of his servants. Is this typically the way you think of a Pharaoh over Egypt? No, because we're associated so much with thinking about the one that Moses encounters more than 300 years later. So here it is. He says, he made a feast for all his servants. Is he mindful for two servants who aren't present? A chief cupbearer and a chief baker? Apparently he thinks of them. He says, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Now, here it is. I want you to think about from the point of view of the cupbearer. Does it happen just the way Joseph said? It does. But have you ever had something that somebody makes a statement, and then it happens, and you go, is that just coincidence? And then all of a sudden, what else does the chief cupbearer have? He knows the interpretation of what he told the baker. Now, here comes the next part. Verse 22. But he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Right, twice. Would that affect your mind? And they go, wow, pretty grasping of your attention, right? Now, you see what's at hand here, then look at verse 23. He says, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Here he is restored to the very presence of Pharaoh, just like Joseph had told him, a man who woke up 3 days earlier and was so sad because of his dream. Joseph tells him what it means. It happens exactly the way that Joseph said. It happens the exact same way that he said is going to happen for the chief baker. And now here he is restored to Pharaoh, putting that cup into Pharaoh's hand, just like Joseph said. And you think, how many opportunities to put it into Pharaoh's hand and to think of a Hebrew boy who was kidnapped and is in prison and is innocent, and he forgets all about it. Now, he didn't remember Joseph. You ever felt like you were forgotten? You ever had those situations in life? You feel like you've done things according to Christ, and then you just get forgotten about. And so many times when we get forgotten, we get troubled. Because who are we really looking at? We're looking at ourselves. Quick reminder, if you've recently read through the book of Esther, in Esther chapter 2, it's the time of the Medes and the Persians, and Ahasuerus is king. And there's two men, Bigtha and Theresh, who are out to make a plot against him, seemingly to kill him. And if you remember, there's a man who's there, not of his own accord, by the name of Mordecai. And in being there, he learns of a plot where they're going to destroy, they want to do something against King Ahasuerus. And he tells his relative, Esther, and Esther reports it to the king in Mordecai's name. Yet nothing is done for Mordecai. It's written down in the chronicles of the king. And then time passes, and whenever you get over to Esther chapter 6, all of a sudden there's a plot against Mordecai by a man by the name of Haman. And he wants to completely annihilate Mordecai. Cannot stand him. would love to see him hanging on the gallows that he's built outside of his own house. But that night, the king can't sleep. And because he can't sleep, he looks for something to listen to that will put him to sleep. And so he calls for the Chronicles to be read to him. And he hears about a man by the name of Mordecai who had spared his life. And the next morning, whenever he encounters Haman coming in to ask for the life of Mordecai, he says, "What should be done for a man to be honored by the king?" And of course, Haman is so self-centered and proud that he thinks he must be talking about me. And he gives off a list of things that he thinks would be wonderful. And then Ahasuerus tells Haman, "That's what I want you to do for Mordecai." Exactly at the right moment, he brings it together. And yet here's Joseph in Genesis 41. You know how long it's going to be before he talks to Pharaoh. It's going to be another 2 years. And he's going to wait. If you've ever been forgotten, I want to show you something in the New Testament. Look over at 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. Look down at verse 6. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6. "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time." Have you noticed this in your own life, that God's timing is perfect? Sometimes situations go much longer than you want them to. Sometimes you think you may have just been forgotten in what's going on. And really, what's it time to do? Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. And when the time is right, he will lift you up. Because if you lift yourself up, what's going to happen? You'll fall. If he lifts you up, is there any way to take you down? His hand is mighty. Now, if you notice the statement here, is he going to do it at the right time for Joseph? Did he do it at the right time for Mordecai? Did he do it at the right time for Esther? Did too for her. You start to see these situations. Did he do it at the right time for Jesus? He did. Whenever he dies, it's at the right time. They even talked about that way in Galatians chapter 4. What about Peter? Is he lifted up at the right time? If you think about what happens in Acts chapter 2, if he'd have been treated that way a year before, would that have been good for Peter? No, he had a lot of things that needed to be addressed first. And you see, here's the timing. And if you ever get to a point where you wonder, how come I'm not being lifted up? How come I'm being forgotten? How come I'm not being remembered? Here's the spiritual response. Humble yourselves under his almighty hand. Fear God and remember his commandments. Now, if you notice another aspect of this verse 7, here's what else it takes to patiently wait. Remember, love is patient and love is kind. Fruit of the Spirit, patience. Verse 7, he says, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. You think Joseph was concerned that he'd be in that prison for the rest of his days? An innocent man who'd been kidnapped? You think Mordecai, I'm not sure he knew about Haman's plot, yet he was delivered. Isn't that awesome to think that God can deliver you even when you don't know you're being pursued? You think about Jesus. 9 times in Jesus' life, they sought to kill him. Yet he always escapes until the time is right. And then God lifts him up and delivers him. Now, if you notice here, there's going to be plenty of times for anxiety where you will get pulled in 2 directions at once, which is what anxiety literally means. Being pulled in a fleshly way and being pulled in a spiritual way. And you'll have to decide, am I going to cast, and it is a fishing term, is what you would expect from Peter, will you cast all your anxieties on him? Humble yourself under his almighty hand. You might think, how do you cast all your anxieties on him? You humble yourself. And you go, his commands are what reign here. Not my desire. Maybe if I just speak up. And if you notice, Joseph did speak up, but it just so happens the cupbearer forgot him. You know why he forgot him? Because the Lord's in control. Isn't that something? We need to remember that more, especially in times of anxiety, especially in times of impatience, of going, am I going to rely on him? Am I going to cast all my anxieties on him? And notice where the verse finishes. What do we need to know? He cares for you. He's not just sitting back and going, well, I'm not going to do anything because I really want to see him suffer. He said, no, the perfect time is coming. And I know, are they going to respond out of humility? He already knows. He knows the outcome before we know the beginning. And to see these things come to pass. Now, that's how we need to respond. And if you look down a little bit further, look at verses 8 and 9. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. He says, you got to be sober in spirit. Don't get caught up in you. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. And he said in the verse before, in verse 5, what does God show to the humble? Grace. Did he show grace to Joseph? Show grace to Mordecai, show grace to Esther, show grace to Peter. Did Jesus receive grace? It's not grace in the sense of forgiving of sin, but he's shown grace. Now, he's full of grace and truth, John 1. Notice how it continues on, verse 9. But resist him, and how are you going to do it? Firm in your faith. Are you going to keep on trusting God or not? He says, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. Are you the only one who has to deal with these things? Sometimes when anxiety hits, we feel like we're the only ones. But that's not reality, is it? The reality is, there's a lot of other people going through this too. And what's the advice we should give? Wait humbly. Cast all your anxiety on him. Wait for his timing. Stand firm in the faith. And you think of the, be sober in the way you think. And understand other people have overcome this too. God has taken them to overcome. Will he not show us the same things? Now, real quickly before we get done, look over at Colossians chapter 2. Just so we can tie up this thing on dreams, so that we're not thinking everything we dream is real. Colossians chapter 2. Look down at verse 18. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of the angels, taking his stand on visions he has seen. And where do those visions come from? Inflated without cause by his fleshly mind. People dream a lot of fleshly stuff. It says, don't think just because you had a dream that, oh, this is the way that God wants me to go. Because if you start thinking that way, which direction will you be headed? You'll be headed fleshly thinking away from God rather than going towards Him and being spiritually thinking. Now, there's some other things. I'll just read this to you. Make a note. Jude 1:8 talks about, in the same way these men also by dreaming defile the flesh and reject authority and revile angelic majesties. There's where how far dreams will take you away from God. You'll revile God's own messengers. How bad is that? And come to understand, here we are, all these things together. God did use dreams and visions. In Acts chapter 2, it's even prophesied about by Joel of what Peter says. He's going to speak to young men and old men in dreams and visions. And he did use that, especially in the book of Acts. Think about Ananias. Think about him going to Saul. About Paul has a vision in terms of Macedonia. Cornelius has a vision. Peter goes to Cornelius because of the vision of the sheets that comes down. You realize if outsiders have dreams, they all seem to point in the same direction. Listen to God. It's not all these other things. So keep in mind, don't let your dreams take over your world and take you away from God. Remember the commandments that we have. If you think you've been forgotten, you haven't been. He knows every sparrow that falls. He's mindful of you and me for sure. You don't forget your own children, do you? You never will. All right. Have a good rest of the week.